Welcome to an especially challenging edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving, and I'm taking this all very seriously.
And I'm Ken Rudin, and Ron, is it the reason it's so challenging? Because we're going to be talking about Congressman Anthony Weiner?
Ken, you, as a New Yorker, know perfectly well that the congressman pronounces his last name Weiner, and thereby, and thereby hangs a tale. The congressman's defense in this entire matter, which I'm sure the listener is already aware of, with respect to his twittering a photograph which was on the internet of himself.
Wait. We don't know if it's of himself, of a man from the waist down.
In a state of excitement, which this congressman is not prepared to say is not him.
You know, I can't say with certitude. My system was hacked. Pictures can be manipulated. Pictures can be dropped in and inserted.
I think we can agree with most casual observers that's not a very satisfying response from the congressman.
Well, first of all, for the longest time, this has been going on
six days, announced
to the listener that this is Wednesday afternoon we're doing this, a day earlier than usual. And, of course, something could change the story the next 24, 48, 72, 116 hours.
Which would be almost a whole day.
That's right. But initially, it seemed like an absolute non-story, that the photograph was sent.
Said it was a prank.
Came from Anthony Weiner's Twitter account to this college student in Seattle, this photo of this waist-down man, gentleman. Whatever, man. Well, he was a gentleman.
with a pair of shorts on.
Right. So anyways, but aside from some websites and blogs, the mainstream medium, and we just thought it was just stupid and who cares?
Passing story, who
exactly.
cares? And it was just, you know, a little bit of a goof on the Chris Lee story right. from New York earlier this year about posting a picture of himself, his torso, in an attempt to get the attention of a woman he was trying to entreat. That story had completely unfolded months ago. The congressman has resigned. His seat has been taken over by the other party. I think there is unquestionably a certain degree of payback here in the sense that there are many who would like to see the political career of Anthony Weiner come a cropper because of this incident. But the congressman is, it seems to me, overwhelmingly responsible for the fact that the story is still a story five days later.
Yes, and I agree. And
non-answers to obvious questions.
And when we're talking about payback, first of all, Anthony Weiner has a proclivity to tweet a lot and be very sarcastic and acerbic and wise guy-ish. And, you know, he's the kind of guy who, look,
could be doing this podcast.
Exactly. You either love him, and many people do, or you hate him, and many people do. And so, obviously, anything that gets Anthony Weiner embarrassed is probably just desserts, according to some people. But it was not the right wing. It doesn't seem like it's the right wing who got him in this position. It seems like it's Anthony Weiner himself, in the sense that, why didn't you hire the FBI? If this was a hack, why not call the FBI? Why not call the Capitol Police? Why, instead, did he hire an attorney to come up with some kind of a defense? That just seems so weird. It's begging for answers.
It is. And the problem for him politically is that we didn't have the answers back last weekend to kill this story in its aborning, and that would have probably kept us from having to spend any time on it at all. As it is, it has become a serious threat to his political future, which included, in his particular case, a very strong possibility he would run for mayor of New York in 2013, one of the major political offices in the imagination of America.
Oh, well, first of all, that's not a possibility. That's a definite. I mean, he's run for mayor before. Once he lost the primary, once he dropped out before the primary, we know he was planning to run again in 2013. Whether this affects his hold on his congressional seat in, I guess, centered in Brooklyn, that's very unlikely. It's a solidly Democratic seat.
Solidly Democratic, but if he becomes, sense or another, a laughingstock, or worse yet, if he seems to be hiding some sort of, as you say, proclivities or activities that would be not necessarily a legal problem for him, but we can't rule anything out at this point, he's clearly protecting either some aspect of his own behavior or some other person. He says the only person he's trying to protect is his wife, whom he just married a matter of months
five minutes ago.
But he has left himself vulnerable here in a way that could spell the end of his political ambition.
This is the kind of thing that late-night comedians just feast over.
Endlessly.
And so the reason nobody talks about Chris Lee except for us is because he resigned pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And that was a big shock. And I have a feeling the Republican leadership, led by Speaker Boehner, decided that Chris Lee could not stay any longer in Congress.
He had to go. They spelled it out.
And I don't even know if we're look, this could be a hoax, as people say. This could be nothing. And in Anthony Weiner's defense, you could say, well, look, why are we spending time on this? But it's his lack of
Transparency,
honest, transparency and honest answers
integrity
is what keeps us going.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he is an amazing debater. He's excellent. He knows his stuff. He doesn't back down. Usually when he goes into the Fox's den on Fox News, he usually gives better than he gets. And yet he seemed just so unprepared, or at least unwilling or unable, to give some kind of coherent defense. When he was approached by Dana Bash of CNN this week, when all she wanted to talk about was the scandal, he said, let's talk about the debt limit. Ron, let's talk about the debt limit.
So I'm the guy who gets to talk about the debt limit. This was the week in which the House decided that it had not made its position clear enough about not allowing an increase in the debt ceiling without some sort of major change in federal spending or budgeting policy or both. They actually held a vote on it. And this was an unusual circumstance in which the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Dave Camp, stood up and said, I'm going to put forward a bill that is what the president wants. It's a clean bill raising the debt limit so that the federal government can go on deficit spending into the months and years to come. And I'm going to tell everybody to vote against it. It is unusual for a committee chairman to bring a bill and ask everyone to vote against it.
Well, it reminds me basically of Harry Reid bringing the Paul Ryan budget for a vote in the Senate when he knew it would go down and hoped it would go down. I mean, it's a political game.
That's
but,
right.
But absolutely, this was a gimmick. This was a matter of fact, they waited until after the markets closed. They had to vote at like 6:30 in the evening.
This is humorous. The market was having a big up day, about 125 points, something of that order. One of the better days they've had in some while. While the Congress was debating not raising the debt ceiling, which supposedly is going to, you know, devastate the federal ability to borrow and our economy and so forth, bond market and so on,
right.
Going to be a terrible thing. Meanwhile, the market was going up the whole day long as they anticipated this vote. After the vote, the market dropped a huge amount, the worst day that it's had in many months, almost 300 points on the Dow. And yet almost no one that I heard all day long was associating that drop with anything other than economic statistics, not with the vote by the House with regard to the debt limit.
But I think that makes sense. First of all, everybody knew that the vote was a joke. Everybody in the Republican leadership told Wall Street that we're going to do this vote, even though we know it's not serious. The last thing they wanted was to repeat what happened with the TARP vote when the Republicans voted no on it and the stock market dropped, what, 700 points?
700, 800 points. Well, that was
right.
That was a much more critical moment in the sense that you did have banks on the brink of failure. And the idea that the federal government was not going to step in and do any rescuing really seriously right. panicked the market. But in this particular instance, is it not going to at least create an impression in some people's minds that the vote was taken late at night after the stock market closed, as you said, so as not to affect the market, and the next day the market takes a big step off the table. I don't think that those two events were causal, but you're going to create a certain kind of atmosphere with these brinksmanship actions here in Washington, clearly each one hoping to use economic pressure from the reaction of the bond market and from the stock market on each other. Is that going to be completely without consequence?
Well, honestly, I thought the vote was a joke, a sham, and everybody acknowledged it was done with a wink. I think that obviously with Tim Geithner saying that August 2nd is the date we all have to worry about, then if they vote not to raise the debt limit, then I think we jump out the window.
Okay, well, then the House leaders the next day after this vote and with the stock market plummeting went to the White House, and I shouldn't say just the House leaders because the House Republicans went en masse. They got a series of buses and they literally brought the whole gang down Pennsylvania Avenue and went into the East Room and met with the president, and by all reports, well, they described it as cordial, but when they say cordial, what they mean is it was a tough meeting.
Usually when they think it's frank, when they say it's a frank meeting, as they said this one was.
You know that the tempers were right at the surface.
But having said that, the Republicans insist, because these are not professional politicians, these are guys who said, look, I'm not raising the debt limit to $16 trillion.
Well, you're talking about the freshmen now. You're talking about the new people in the House
the
who are not
folks,
professional politicians.
Exactly, who were elected on saying we're not going to keep on doing what we've been doing all this time. And so they're going to say that if you're going to increase the debt limit by $3 trillion or whatever it is, you have to have some kind of corresponding cut in the budget. And I think that I think Boehner and the Republicans have made that clear to the president.
And they're also insisting that anything that is done to close the gap with respect to the federal debt or the annual budget deficit be entirely cuts in spending and in no sense any increases in revenues, that they're putting off the table entirely, which is part of the reason that the talks between the two sides are going nowhere.
Well, there is this August 2nd deadline. I don't know how real it is. It seems pretty real.
It seems pretty real. We're already past the point where we've hit the dead limit.
You have basically 2 months for something to happen before, I guess, you know, I mean,
we find new and uncharted territory. We're going to be off of the cliff as it's always been defined since 1917 with these debt limits that Congress artificially put on federal borrowing. We've never seen what happened when we went beyond that period and when the authority of the federal government to borrow was not clear.
It's easy to cite polls that show that the American people are against raising the debt limit.
Of course they are. Why in the world would they be in favor of it unless they're economists or business people who know how these markets work?
But when you see the stock market tumbling, if you do on August 2nd or when there's no vote to increase the debt limit, then you'll see perhaps a shift in public feeling about this.
It's a fascinating question. To what degree do politicians respond to polls other than with respect to elections? Do they actually look at what the polls are saying about, for example, people's reaction to Medicare? CNN just came out with a poll saying that 58% of the people in the country oppose the Ryan Medicare plan, and only 35% are willing to say they're in favor of it. That would seem to be the end of anything if you have that kind of heavy score against it when it's that major a political issue.
What was the poll that's showing people against the Obama health care?
It was never that heavy.
It was more negative than positive.
It was more negative than positive unless you asked people about the individual elements. If you asked them, what about the Obama plan? They were negative. If you asked them about each of the elements of the Obama plan, it was a very different story
poll. But yes, it's one thing for the American people to say they were against the Ryan plan to revamp Medicare, but what if I said, but are you in favor of keeping it the way it is now and we're going to bankruptcy or something like that? Obviously,
it's always a matter of how you phrase the question, which is why I asked the underlying question here, which is how much do politicians really pay attention to polls like this? My guess is the Democrats didn't pay enough attention to the polls they were getting back on the health care bill in 2009 and 2010, and the Republicans completely ignoring and doubling down on the Ryan plan right now in the House and Senate and saying this is our negotiating position until we see something else from Obama. That's not a very good position for them to be in either.
No, especially in the wake of what happened in New York 26 when, if anything, that seemed to be a referendum on the Ryan plan.
Speaking of polls, the Pew Research Center is coming out with its latest poll on the Republican field of candidates for president. Now, this is defined to include several of the people who have officially declared and a number of the people who are still in a kind of flirtation mode, such as Sarah Palin, who's on this famous bus tour of the Eastern Seaboard, starting in Washington with the Rolling Thunder Parade and
the National Archives. Let's
be fair. It's
no talk.
We
express.
The people, one nation. We don't release the traveling schedule to the media because that's their problem. Let them find us wherever
they're journalists.
We are. We're just on a family vacation and running into some ordinary Americans in ordinary places like the National Archives and the Liberty Bell. We're just having a good time.
But let's go back to, you're talking about the folks who are about to announce the day of this podcast. Mitt Romney will be announcing in New Hampshire. On Monday, Rick Santorum announces in Pennsylvania, where he served 2 terms in the Senate. And later this month, we expect Michelle Bachmann to announce something in her hometown of Waterloo, Iowa. Did you know she was born in Waterloo, Iowa?
Yeah, but that's not a great name for a town if you're talking about starting a big campaign. But at the same time, it is great to have been born in Iowa because that's the state where if she's going to have any credibility as a candidate, she's going to have to establish it. But interestingly, the best news that Barack Obama has had all week, with the economic data weakening and the jobs data very disappointing and everybody getting worried about the recovery losing steam, the best news he's had is the news about the Republican candidates, because at least in this Pew Research poll and also in other polls that have been done recently, there's not a lot of excitement about any of these people. Only a quarter of voters, about 25%, have an excellent or a good impression of this field of candidates, and it's a fairly long list of people. We're not excluding people just because they haven't officially declared yet. This is a long list of candidates, and of them, only 4, Mitt Romney, Sarah Palin, we've mentioned, Newt Gingrich, and Ron Paul, are recognized by a clear majority of Americans who even know their names. I know it's typical.
June 2011,
I know it's typical.
No debates.
And among those people who do know who these people are, Palin and Gingrich, 63% of those who know those names say there is no chance they will vote for that person for president. 60% say there is no chance they would support Ron Paul for president. And only 51% say there's some chance, at least, that they would vote for Mitt Romney. for president. Right.
First of all, this poll shows what we've been saying all along, that Sarah Palin, Newt Gingrich, and Ron Paul, none of whom will win the Republican nomination for president. Mitt Romney is just declaring. He's been running since 2007. Look, if this were a poll in November of 2011 that we're not happy with the field, then I would be worried. But again, I always go back to 1991 when the Democrats were saying, oh no, Jay Rockefeller's not going to run, and Al Gore is not running, and Mario Cuomo's not running, and Dick Gephardt is not running. And right, so, right. You know, obviously we're stuck with Paul Tsongas, Jerry Brown, and Bill Clinton. Is that the best we can do?
No, I don't remember that people were saying they were stuck with Bill Clinton in the summer of 1991. They were saying, will this young, ambitious governor of Arkansas get in the race, because it does seem to be such an empty field. The other difference, right, of course, was that in the spring of 1991, we were just coming off a successful war in terms of war with Iraq, freeing Kuwait, and President Bush at that time was just coming down from a record-setting 90% approval in the Associated Press. So there was a little bit different circumstances.
I'm just saying that dissatisfaction with the Republican field of candidates in June of 2011, look, if the economy improves, and many people think it could, if it improves, then it doesn't matter who the Republican nominee is. If it doesn't improve, then,
maybe it doesn't matter who the Republican nominee
right.
is. You're essentially saying this could be a 1980 sort of situation where people become so disillusioned with a first-term Democratic president that they just want him out of there, and they're willing to turn to somebody that previously had not seemed to be that great a juggernaut. In that case, it was Ronald Reagan.
That could vary. I wasn't thinking of 1980, but when you think of prior to the convention in Detroit in 1980, Ronald Reagan was still perceived by many Americans as too far to the right, too extreme, too much of an actor, but it was really a referendum on Jimmy Carter. Ultimately, 2012 will be a referendum on Barack Obama.
All right, and we still have a number of people who, while they have said they're not running for president, continue to generate a certain amount of interest in their potential candidates.
And that's what's interesting about what's happened this week with, the excitement of Mitt Romney. I mean,
he's announcing.
What's
so
weird about this? In the old days, here I go again with the old days, but when you think of the old days when Bobby Kennedy announced his presidency, just an exciting moment.
1968.
But here you pre-announce, then you announce an exploratory committee, and then you say you're going to announce.
The interest goes out of
right,
it.
Right, a 4 or 5 step thing. But for all the Romney news, for all whatever's going on with the Republican field, the headlines this week was Sarah Palin,
whose name recognition, by the way, in this new Pew poll is 97%. So virtually perfect name recognition. And yet only 34% say that there's any chance that they could vote for her. And this is among people
all
who,
voters.
These are all voters among people who recognize her name, which is virtually everyone in this poll. Now, you can talk about people coming from nowhere, like Jimmy Carter did, and to some degree Barack Obama did, but it's very hard to imagine that kind of a number turning around. Yet, the media, and we are part of this, are endlessly fascinated and, I think, to some degree compelled to cover her as though she were a candidate. Imagine if we didn't. Imagine if she were riding up the Eastern Seaboard in this enormous bus that says One Nation on the side of it, doing all these things that she knows perfectly well are catnip for the media, and we ignored it. What would we be accused of then?
Solid journalism.
Would we not be accused of ignoring her because we had some sort of animus against her?
Well, see, do I think there is an animus against her? Yes. Do I think it's deserved? Perhaps. Do I think the media treated her poorly in many regards in 2008? Absolutely. The rumors that Trigg is really Bristol's child, and some of the stuff was just awful. But having said that, she has a certain contempt for the media, which is fine, but I've never seen...
Is it contempt or is it fear? As you just suggested, that she was carpet bombed in 2008, and is she not having a fairly natural reaction to that kind of treatment?
I don't think it's fear, because she has enough supporters and she has enough people in the amen corner in Fox News and her fans on Facebook and Twitter and things like that, that, right on, you go, girl. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's fear at all. I think it's just they reap what they sowed.
All right. And they are, to some degree, here again, doubling down on what are their existing characteristics and the places where they know they're popular. If she knows that she is the candidate of Fox viewers, and she is herself a Fox contributor, and she's only talking to her colleague from Fox, Greta Van Susteren, as her outlet to the outside world.
Isn't that weird, though?
Well, it is a little weird, and I've never seen a campaign like it, but it's very hard not to see this as at least a shadow campaign when she does things like go to New York and have a pizza supper with Donald Trump, which is going to generate an enormous amount of exactly the kind of media coverage we're talking about. And then she goes into New Hampshire essentially on the day that Mitt Romney is announcing for president.
You mentioned Donald Trump, and that's what I, basically, to me, this is very Trump-esque. It's celebrity, it's knowing that the media will fawn at every comment she makes, wherever she goes. Are you going to run? I'm thinking about it. Are you going to run? Well, I haven't decided yet.
Kind of contemplating it.
Oh, man.
Kind of contemplating it?
But see, here's the thing. I know this has nothing to do with ideology. For example, Michelle Bachmann, equally conservative, adored by the Tea Party folks, at least she's honest about what she's doing. She's meeting with the media. She's hiring staff in Iowa. Sarah Palin is really an in-your-face campaign, which maybe the media deserve it. But
well, this is the Trump-esque aspect of it, as you mentioned, that she is behaving very much like Donald Trump and suggesting that perhaps what she is up to here is a kind of celebrity branding exercise.
I was watching Fox News this week. To a person, everybody felt that Sarah Palin was not running. Now, of course, they should say that because if they thought she was running, she'd be out of a job, and they should do to her what they did to Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum.
Except that Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich's numbers weren't anywhere near
exactly,
as important to them as Sarah Palin's.
Do you think is she running? I say no.
I don't think so. This is not the way you run for president. This is the way you run for Sarah Palin. This is the way you run for Donald Trump. And I think they were serving their own causes very well, but they are not running for president.
Is Rick Perry running for president?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Again, and I know we're in the minority here. We were agreeing with each other, but a lot of other people are out there really pushing this stock, buying cheap shares of Rick Perry. I don't see him as a national candidate.
You know how it changed? They always ask him, will he run? He always says no. This time he said, I'm going to think about it.
I will give it some reconsideration.
Yeah.
And that was enough. That was like a declaration of candidacy.
Right.
Chris Christie from New Jersey, all he had to do was agree to go to a conference on, I believe it's on education in Iowa, at the invitation of Terry Branstad, his friend who is the governor of Iowa. And that was enough for a lot of people
and
to decide
he said, oh,
he's
but,
running.
Yeah, but he said over and over, Christie said, look, do I have to commit suicide to prove to you that I'm not running?
No, the man is very savvy.
Yeah.
I have a lot of respect for Chris Christie, what he's already accomplished as a governor in New Jersey, whether you like it or you don't. Mm-hmm. He's accomplished a lot. And I don't think he's running for president. I think he has the good sense to see that this isn't his time. If there is going to be a time, this isn't it. And I think there are probably a lot of other people who have the same attitude. We've seen it from Haley Barbour. We've seen it from Mitch Daniels. We've seen it from Mike Huckabee.
Still awaiting John Huntsman. But the Rick Perry thing is interesting.
I think Huntsman runs.
I think Huntsman runs.
And I think he's a breath of fresh air who's a little bit different from the rest of the field.
Who goes as far as Bruce Babbitt.
Well, maybe so. And Bruce Babbitt was another media favorite. People always talk about the media favorite.
Right.
The media favorite frequently, if not usually, goes out very early.
But Rick Perry won. If he does run, he'd be the only guy really from the South. I don't think you really consider Newt Gingrich a Southerner. No, he doesn't sound like a Southerner.
He doesn't talk.
He's born in Pennsylvania, and he's really a Washington figure.
He represented a district in Georgia. That's about as Southern as he gets.
But Rick Perry reminds me in some ways of like Fred Thompson in the sense that I just can't see him working for it. I mean, you have to work hard. And, you know, being governor of Texas is not the toughest job in the world.
I don't think his numbers are that good in Texas for the office of president of the United States. And I don't think that people in Texas have been that crazy about him over the 10 years. And that's a long time to be governor of any state.
Longest Texas governor in history.
And longest serving governor currently in the United States. Those numbers aren't that great either, although he has won the elections. And it just doesn't feel as though that's gathering any kind of real momentum either. But the Republicans continue to look because, as I say, only 25% of the people in the country really have a strong positive impression of their current field.
And do you know what Rick Perry was doing in 1988? He was Al Gore's Texas campaign manager.
You can win a lot of bar bets with that. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.